So this is interesting. This is from Forbes, July 19th, so about a month ago. 2024 U.S. exports to Israel jumped 962% in one munitions category. U.S. merchandise trade with Israel is off to the fastest start in 9 years, according to Census Bureau data. The biggest reason for the increase through February, the latest data available, is a 962% increase from the same 2 months last year in a category of U.S. exports that includes bombs, grenades, cartridges, and other related parts. The $370 million total, however, amounts to a sliver of the billions of dollars of U.S. military aid provided to Israel annually. The Council on Foreign Relations has done a pretty thorough job in explaining U.S. aid to Israel and the rest of the Middle East here. It's there. We'll link to it. U.S. sales of military equipment for all foreign governments was a record-setting $238 billion in 2023, according to the State Department. We're also going to link to a Twitter account called Menchosinit. It's M-E-N-C-H-0-S-I-N-T. That account has been following all sorts of manufacture and shipments of munitions to Israel. For example, in the month of August, 14 munition shipments already. This is being recorded the last week of August. 14 munition shipments to Israel from Dover Air Force Base in the month of August. 129,000 kilograms of munitions per shipment, estimated. In the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. This is Rob. This is your Highlands Bunker podcast. Hello, comrades and friends. Tonight, we have a very special guest, Dwayne Bensing from the ACLU of Delaware. Thank you for coming.
Glad to be here.
We have tons of stuff to talk about. We were going to talk to Carl about a lot of inside sort of election information. That guy's, mum's the word on that guy. He's tightened up. He's zipped up. You can't get a fucking story out of this guy.
They don't call it secret sauce for nothing.
They don't. Well, thank you for coming. Before we get to like the good gossip and the shit talking, which I know everybody's just waiting for it. They love it. They love the gossip. I do want to talk about some ACLU work, and of course, I want to talk about myself.
Really?
Come on.
Suck.
Look. This week, the ACLU represented the Delaware Call and myself as an appellant. I've been telling people I'm an appellant. They were like, what does that mean? I was like, don't worry about it. we've mentioned this before. The Call has FOIA'd a lot of police information, and we didn't get any of it. And the ACLU has represented us in a lawsuit by saying that we should get it. I'm not a lawyer, but what I can tell you before Dwayne gets into the sort of the details of it is that FOIA is meant to be pretty open. Like, the default is the public should get the information. There are exclusions, of course, but the exclusions are pretty detailed. You have to meet, very clear criteria. And also, not only do you have to meet the criteria, you have to explain why the criteria applies, which this will not come as a surprise to anybody who listens to this. The police do not do. And so we made that argument in front of Judge Clark this week. Casey Danoff, who was a fellow at the ACLU, made the argument this week. And we'll see how it goes. But I appreciate the ACLU picking this up, and I wonder, what you want to add to it, or sort of explain exactly what we're after here.
Sure, and certainly props to Casey. She's the subject matter expert here, and today was actually the last day of her fellowship with the ACLU of Delaware, so leaving a huge hole in our hearts, but we wish her well on her federal clerkship and the rest of her career. The FOIA has been of interest to the ACLU of Delaware for quite some time, and really, you know, we're thankful to the Delaware Call and you, Rob, for pushing forward on this transparency issue. You described it perfectly well. The idea behind our Freedom of Information Act laws, these are sunshine laws, are that this is our government, right? And that we, therefore, have not only the authority to see what our government is up to, but a democratic obligation to watch what our government is doing. And what I've discovered in my time at the ACLU of Delaware is that the institution of the state of Delaware really believes that it operates separate and apart from the people to whom it is responsible for governing and to whom it owes any governing authority that it has. And that is even more so the case when we are discussing police. And so, you know, the essence of this FOIA request, the way FOIA works is you send a request to a state agency and you say, this is the information that I want. And the agency has an obligation at that point to help you, the requester, get the information that you are seeking. And so that's one thing I want to point out to folks. FOIA your agencies. If you're curious about what's happening, where the dollars are being spent, what policies and practices are being followed or not, FOIA your agency. And they should help you in getting that information that you're seeking. This is your government. These are your documents. You paid for them. So that's step one. Our requests were pretty narrowly tailored to specific information, including the names of police officers and whether they were certified or decertified in Delaware or elsewhere, what their certification status was. This is important because we've had recent reporting that police officers decertified in other states then come to Delaware, are hired, and then commit the same kind of atrocious crimes against citizens in the state of Delaware as they had committed in our neighboring jurisdictions. These are not top secret files. The names of our police force is public information. These are public servants. And it's really, to me, this case underscores the threat of the alternative to a state with an active FOIA. And that is, their argument boils down to the desire to have a secret police force. And that should terrify everybody in the state of Delaware, that our Delaware State Police don't even want you to know who they are. How can you hold a police officer accountable if you can't even identify that police officer? So this is quintessentially public information. Public servant's name is certainly public information. And the argument by Delaware State Police was that the information we sought may jeopardize the safety of the police officers, because we live in a time in which they filed a sworn affidavit that a canine showed up at police headquarters. We don't really have any details about what that canine was doing or what the result of that canine interaction was.
I was very confused about that because I didn't understand what they were talking about.
I was like, was it Ren 10 10 auditioning? Like, I'm not really sure.
Yeah, they were like, well, there is some information out there, but we're not going to verify if it's true because a dog showed up somewhere.
Right.
I didn't understand what that was all about, actually, because I listened to the arguments, and I knew sort of what the arguments were, and I knew what the declines were, but I didn't know a lot of the details, and I didn't understand that at all.
No. And so here's the issue, and Rob, you said it perfectly in the opening here, is that when there is a denial of a FOIA request, because the default is that they share the information, that the information created by our government is public information. And if they're not going to share it. There's got to be a good reason to do it. And all of the reasons were really fuzzy. All the declines were essentially this kind of safety of our officers narrative without really explaining why giving us the names of officers would result in some public safety risk or police safety risk. They invoked a section of the FOIA exemptions that were related to preventing terrorist attacks. They invoked LEOBOR, the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights. And so there was the smattering of, oh, no, we can't tell you who your police force is because we're scared that the public will know who their police force is.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one was sort of like the employment history and sort of giving us what information you have on, you know, where these people might have worked before, whether they were decertified before. And what I found interesting was, you know, they would use a reason and say, oh, we're not doing it for this reason. Well, how does answering this question or providing these documents or providing this information, how does that sort of bring up this problem? And that's never explained. It's just like, we're going to cite these exemptions, but not explain why that exemption is relevant. And so, yeah, I was just happy to have that discussion on the public record, you know.
Yeah.
And just, you know, I saw today there was a school psychologist who has been arrested for child rape. Very bad. And apparently he, you know, faked his credentials. And during an investigation, they figured that out. And they figured out who was responsible. And the discipline was meted out for those who were responsible. You know, people in the Brandywine School District and at the school at Lombardi. And all of that came out today in a Chris Barish WHYY article. And I thought, well, that's good. You know, we know sort of we can track what happened here. You know, bad things happen. It's horrible, obviously. But now the public sort of knows what happened and who is going to be held responsible and how. But like that really doesn't happen with the police.
Right.
It was a very stark sort of thing, like, oh, okay, it, you know, for educators, this is the process. For police, it's a secret process.
Right. And police have such responsibility and duty and authority over the rest of us that the burden ought to be even higher for what their, you know, personal privacy interests are compared to the interests of the public whom they serve. And to be clear, we weren't seeking any, you know, social security number, residential address, none of that personal information. We're talking about the name. We're talking about the salary. The salary argument was really interesting. They apparently give the salary information to this website, Open the Books, but then in their filing said, we cannot confirm nor deny that any of the information that Open the Books has published is accurate. So it's like, it's already out there. You have it, but it may not be true.
Well, not only that, the funny thing was that was their answer, you know, to the FOIA request. Hey, we want this information. They're like, well, go to this website. Well, like, is that website good? They're like, we don't know.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like, okay.
And they have this information. I mean, and this is another, I was really, you know, I don't know what to think about this, but I guess for folks out there who are struggling to put their resume together, consider becoming a police officer, because apparently for that job application, no resume required. They do not collect resumes to become a police officer.
Yes, we asked for resumes and CVs of every Delaware State police officer. And yeah, they admitted this week that they don't ask for them. They don't have them, or they're not required. I assume, you know, some officers have them and some don't. But yeah, it was very enlightening. to find out sort of what the arguments were and what's there and what they feel very comfortable in admitting that they don't have or they can't verify. Wild.
I mean, when we're talking about more broadly, you know, we're in this era of police accountability. I mean, how can you hold an anonymous police force accountable? How do you do that?
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say, I'll let you talk about a couple other ACLU initiatives right now, but I did notice today, within the last week, there has been one more detailed narrative of police misconduct sent from the Post Commission to the Criminal Justice Council. I don't know if you saw this, a third one. So in 1 year, we've had three misconducts. I'm sure you believe that.
Yep.
This one was from the Dover Police, finally a regular police force, not the Delaware River and Bay Authority or the Division of Alcohol and Tobacco Enforcement. This was a Dover police officer who actually they found out had hit a parked car while they were driving because they were texting and driving or on their phone, did not report it, and then just left the car there. So they got disciplined for having a fender bender that they did not report. And I found that interesting because last month also a Dover police officer had a rifle go off when they were trying to apprehend someone or talk to someone in Dover. We don't know what happened with that. So rifle goes off. We don't know. You ding the car up. Criminal Justice Council knows. So, you know, do that what you will with that. You know, I don't know what to say. You know, a lot of people are sort of hanging their hat on the things that we're supposed to get based on the 2023 reforms. And it seems like we're getting played a little bit.
You think?
We're getting played. I don't like it. We're getting played. They're laughing at us.
Right.
They're like, ha, ah,
we fell
you.
For it. I mean, and
like
everybody...
a rifle goes off in Dover. They're like, oh, no, we sent a detailed narrative of a guy who had a fender bender.
Right.
That's the misconduct that we're.
Right. Because that's what we were. That's what we had. Community
that's what we're really worried about. Yes.
Outrage about.
Yes. That's the most important thing. Is violence against parked cars.
Yeah. I'm ready to see the second step. Because but didn't everybody say this was the first step?
This was the first, and yes, there's going to be another step, or there was supposed to be another step. We'll see.
We'll see.
That's what people want.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what else is the ACLU working on? I know probation reform is huge. Once again, you know, we kind of got stuck. But I also know that the ACLU has other lawsuits sort of in the fire. So, yeah, before we get into sort of some Democratic Party stuff, let us know what else the ACLU is doing.
We have been busy. We, over the summer, were successful in our summary judgment motion against the state on the vanity license plates. I'd like to make the record clear on Highlands Bunker that the reason that you can't get a new vanity plate is not because of the ACLU. It is because the Department of Motor Vehicles, Division of Motor Vehicles, is too challenged to come up with a constitutional framework for which they may offer new vanity plates moving forward. And we've encouraged them to do
Big Delaware issue here.
It's a big Delaware issue.
Big
it really
people
is.
Love those
it's
plates.
It's a free speech issue. But we were successful, and the response by the state was they took their marbles and went home. But there's a big flash up that comes up on the DMV website saying we're no longer issuing new vanity plates as a result of an injunctive order from a federal district court. So that's been there. If you want a new vanity plate, don't send me your hate mail. Send it to the DMV.
If you want a S-E-X-I-I-I sexy and you can't get it, it's Dwayne's fault.
Let it be known. That's in the good news territory. More good news. We got a report and recommendation from Magistrate Judge Sherry Fallon this summer on our prison health complaint. This is a class action complaint alleging that our Department of Corrections and those contracted to provide health services to those who are incarcerated failed to meet their constitutional and statutory obligations for the provision of health care for those who are incarcerated. And the report and recommendation on the motions to dismiss denied in large part the motions by defendants in that case. So that, if adopted by our district court judge, that case will move forward. We'll get some discovery about some of the systemic failures of our prison healthcare system, which we've known about for years now. And so it's a really great move forward for prison health. We, in bad news, maybe, asterisk, we sought in-person voting for those incarcerated because you all are probably familiar. There was a Supreme Court decision following the 22 election, an order prior to the 22 election that ruled that the vote by mail statute passed, led by Senator Kyle Evans Gay, to allow vote by mail for all Delawareans was struck as unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court, in what I believe is one of the worst Delaware Supreme Court decisions ever, said that the Constitution explicitly listed those who were eligible to cast an absentee ballot, that vote by mail was just another term for absentee ballot. It's not. And that
is
therefore...
Is that what the sticking point was? Was because I remember when it passed, because there was a package that was going to be a constitutional amendment.
That's right.
And it passed the first time.
Yep.
And then the January 6th, you know, then the elections became fake all of a sudden.
Yep.
And so people who passed the first time were like, whoa, elections are fake now. Now we have to not do it.
Yep.
And so because reactionary Republicans pulled back on that.
Yep.
The legislature said, okay, well, we'll just pass it this way, the way that got overturned.
That's right.
And so I was under the impression that kind of people sort of understood that this may get overturned, like that it didn't look kosher. So that it wasn't a huge surprise that it got overturned, but was that it hinged on the idea that the rationale for absentee, which were these reasons, X, Y, Z, A, B, C, did not translate over to a vote by mail necessarily. That was the question.
So in part, and let me tease out a few of these things. I love to talk about this issue. So let me give me a chance.
Do it.
So one, you know, vote by mail and constitutional provisions on absentee voting are issues in other states. Pennsylvania upheld their vote by mail, even though they have similar constitutional language describing who is eligible for an absentee ballot, similarly in Massachusetts. And their vote by mail statutes have been upheld. Delaware Supreme Court was like, we are unique, and we've already told you that in an advisory opinion in 1972, before the fax machine, that this is... That this category is the ceiling of folks who are eligible to vote absentee. But the Constitution permits in Article 5, Section 1, for the General Assembly to determine the methods of voting. And Article 5, Section 4A talks about those who are eligible to cast an absentee ballot. And what I don't think our Supreme Court fully grappled with, well, I know they didn't grapple. They don't even cite the provision of Article 5, Section 1. So they didn't even explore what is the General Assembly's authority under our constitutional framework to determine ways in which people may vote. And Senator Gay's bill was all about the method of voting. That is straight up Article 5, Section 1. She said, if you're an eligible voter, you may cast a ballot by mail. And there are key distinctions between a mail ballot and an absentee ballot. Absentee ballot are for those folks who are outside of their election district on election day, and they may cast a ballot by mail, but they can also cast a ballot. Some of them are eligible to cast a ballot by email. That's not what was in the vote by mail statute. So there are certainly distinctions between our absentee ballot mechanisms and the vote by mail mechanisms, none of which, and the state kind of failed to tease that out. In fact, at the Superior Court, the attorney for the Department of Justice conceded that vote by mail and absentee ballots were one and the same. They are not. That was a mistake to concede that at that point. And further to the mistake was that they didn't fully articulate why this was an Article 5, Section 1 power of the General Assembly. So the language of Article 5, Section 4A on absentee voting says that the General Assembly shall permit certain eligible voters an opportunity to cast an absentee ballot. Now, the plain reading of that language is that that really is a floor, that the General Assembly could do it for others, but it's a guarantee of the right to vote for a sub cohort of eligible voters. And it says, General Assembly, these are the folks. And if you look at the constitutional history here, the Article 5, Section 4A amendment came right after the Supreme Court denied the opportunity for soldiers to vote. There was a Soldier Voting Act that passed in Delaware permitting soldiers placed outside of the state of Delaware to cast a ballot. And the Delaware Supreme Court at that time said, no. You've got to be in the state at the time of the election. Otherwise, you're ineligible to vote. And the General Assembly said, oh, heck no. And they amended our Constitution in direct response to that narrowing principle of who has the right to vote. And you also see, following the Article 5, Section 4A, that the General Assembly, until 1972, looked at Article 5, Section 4A as a floor, not a ceiling. They expanded it in certain specific ways, and really did have an answer to the Supreme Court's hostility to voting rights. I do not understand why, when the equities were weighed by the justices in the Higgin opinion, that they decided to limit the General Assembly's authority under Article 5, Section 1 without even discussing it, and tie their hands to a provision that really wasn't even applicable to the law. I think a lot of people believed, because the General Assembly first tried to amend the Constitution, that's the only way in which we could have gone about doing it. But I think that's one of those things of the failure of courageous lawmaking. And I give a lot of credit to Senator Gay for moving forward and saying, no, we have an obligation to voters to permit this method of voting that worked so well in the 2020 elections under the emergency powers of the General Assembly. So, other states that have grappled with this have said, yeah, this isn't a problem. We can have absentee voting and vote by mail. The General Assembly has the authority to do that. So it was a disappointing opinion from my perspective, and one that we've struggled, because in really important ways, it undermines access to the ballot for people, including those who are incarcerated. Because, as you might imagine, incarceration is not one of the five reasons constitutionally listed as being eligible for an absentee ballot. Nonetheless, Department of Corrections and Department of Elections have worked together to provide absentee applications and, in three instances, a ballot to eligible voters incarcerated. These are people who are serving either misdemeanors and so are not disqualified from access to the ballot, and people who are serving a pretrial sentence. So they've not yet been convicted of anything. They're just being held prior to their convictions. So remember, innocent before proven guilty. So these are folks who are still eligible to vote, and their only access to a ballot is through absentee voting. Well, our Department of Corrections has decided that all mail is suspect now, because that might be how you get contraband into prison facilities. And so all mail gets shipped into a facility in Arizona and then shipped back. There's been huge mail delays. Ballots are supposed to be streamlined through that process, but we have little evidence that that has occurred. Again, only three people in the last two election cycles have successfully voted by absentee ballot in a prison facility.
That's amazing.
It's horrific.
Because there has to be so many people that meet that criteria of being eligible, but they have no way of exercising that.
Absolutely. And let me just, there's a myth that these folks aren't interested in voting. There are jurisdictions throughout the country that have in-prison polling polling booths for people. And in those locations, people incarcerated and eligible to vote turn out in higher numbers than the rest of us on the outside of these prison facilities. So there's no reason to believe that the people incarcerated and eligible in Delaware have less interest.
Yeah, I mean, they have a very direct sort of
stake
in the, what the state does.
Absolutely.
You know, more than most people.
Absolutely. So we argued that in light of the Higgin opinion, where the court so narrowly read who's eligible to cast an absentee ballot, that their short-sightedness actually left out an entire category of eligible voters who have a constitutional right. And so we argued that the only way to thread that needle was to put polling places in those prison facilities. Shockingly, last Friday, federal district judge Jen Hall, in an oral order, said that incarceration included as a business or occupation was, quote, not unreasonable as an interpretation. And so the Department of Elections and Department of Corrections have said, listen, incarceration is included as a business or occupation. I'm sure folks who have loved ones in prison will be heartened to go home and tell them that, hey, guess what? You're employed. It's a ridiculous workaround. And here's the other thing, Rob. There's the state could just do this. The department, Commissioner Albence, Commissioner Tara Taylor with the Department of Corrections, they have full authority to put in polling places in our four prison facilities. They could do this. We have the AG who loves to talk about protecting the right of every eligible voter to have access to the ballot. And the best access to the ballot, the gold standard of access to the ballot, is an in-person polling place in the facility. So they could just do this with the swipe of a pen, with the sending of an email. And they fought us tooth and nail in federal court. So the ruling is the silver lining of the ruling is that now we know that eligible incarcerated voters will not be prosecuted for trying to cast an absentee ballot. It's a crime in Delaware to cast a ballot if you're ineligible to do so. But the AG said, I'm not going to prosecute people who are eligible and incarcerated for casting an absentee ballot. So that's good news. And you have a federal district judge saying, hey, this interpretation is not unreasonable. So any potential challenge to those who vote, challenge to those ballots of folks who vote while incarcerated is unlikely to be upheld by a court. A court's going to say, listen, they have a right to vote. Maybe it's not within the Higgin opinion, but the right to vote is going to withstand the right to, you know, invalidate a ballot because it was cast absentee.
Yeah, classic Delaware story. I mean, our neighbor here lives half the time in Montana, which is not really a liberal state, but a libertarian state. But I mean, they've had mail-in ballots. She's like, you guys don't mail in your ballots here? I'm like, no, we can't. It's not, you know. There's states that I think have done it for 20 years, probably. Washington and Oregon, I think, have done it for two decades. So it's just it's another classic sort of Delaware mentioned sort of story.
Yeah. Well, and let me, you know, and the other, I guess, not silver lining, but the other really call to action from this opinion is how much we really need a constitutional amendment. The constitutional amendment that failed in the second leg that you mentioned early, it was the Dirty Dozen. There were 12 Republican legislators in the House who all supported this bill in 2019 and then switched their vote as soon as their dear leader, Donald J. Trump, told them to. And it's sick. And included in that is gubernatorial candidate Mike Ramone.
I was wondering if you were going to mention
State
that.
State Representative Michael Smith, Representative Brian Shoup, Representative Hensley. These folks all have the moral character of
Carl will beep that out.
Great.
Okay, now's the time. We're going to get into it. First of all, you've just returned from the Windy City. You were officially at the Democratic National Convention. I'm very interested in your take on it. I have to admit, on one hand, that I didn't watch 1 minute of it.
You missed Lil Jon, Rob.
I heard that I missed it, and I don't feel like that I missed it really. But I did hear that I missed it. I will say this again: like you can't like if you follow the news or you do this kind of stuff, you know, you can't really stay away from it. So like I knew what was happening, but like I didn't watch 1 minute live. Thank goodness. I'm not sure. Certainly the fact that Uncle Joe, you know, sort of stepped aside or was pushed aside sort of got everyone excited that there was at least something new, which is fair enough. It is a little bit weird. One day I went online and I saw a photo of, I guess it was Lisa and Chris Coons and Carney. Sarah McBride was sticking her mug in there from the one side, and Kerry Harris was over on the left side. And I thought to myself, these are like some people who were telling me 3 weeks ago that if anybody said that Biden should drop out, they were ageist and they were lunatics, and you never do that. And how dare anybody say this? But 3 weeks hence, you know, it's party time. And so that was a little bit strange. But I feel like, okay, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I remember, I'm a little bit older. I remember the O'Bungler. And the O'Bungler got everybody excited. Even I was excited for the O'Bungler. I thought, this is going to be a new, whole new thing. I remember, actually, on election night, I text my friend, hey, Obama, that's cool. Something new. And he said, yeah, you know what? We have to do some good. But he didn't do any good. And so I feel like that old line from the Beverly Hills Cop movie, the old Eddie Murphy movie, I'm not going to fall for the banana in the tailpipe again. And I feel like I'm not going to fucking fall for the banana in the tailpipe. But what's your, I mean, are you putting the banana in my tailpipe for lack? I mean, look, it's a little bit, that's a sexual innuendo.
Are you coming on to me, Rob?
Look, I mean, look, Carl. Can you get out? Can you step out of here for a second, please?
Give us the room.
Gosh, give me like 10 minutes.
Why you got a lot of faith?
But I mean, you see what I'm saying? I don't. Well, I mean, we're talking about really, you know, sort of pushing the envelope and making sure that everybody has their rights and everybody is heard. But that's not really what the Democratic Party's about, is it? Am I missing something?
A leading question.
Well, sorry. Yeah, I mean. Objection.
Objection.
An attorney would object to that.
Objection. I don't agree with that. I certainly let me just preface all this. This is a special episode of Bunker, because now I've officially taken off my ACLU hat and now have
first
my,
of all,
it's a two-part
series. We always
series.
Have to, like, first of all, Carl probably played music in between.
Fabulous.
The two things.
Okay, great music.
If he didn't do that,
he
we
will.
Always say this.
Lovely.
This is Dwayne just talking about himself.
This
has nothing
Dwayne,
to do.
DNC delegate.
This has
State
nothing to do with the ACLU of Delaware.
Perfect.
Or any kind of affiliation.
Perfect.
That he may have.
All right, we're going to get crazy up in here. Let's take a time machine and go. Let me just and Rob, I shared this a little with you before the show. You know how, into my core, I am a Democrat, for better or worse. And I will tell you, the last several weeks have been so surreal, and not in a positive way necessarily.
Okay.
Let me start with where we are and where we're going, I think, as a party. And I am thrilled with Kamala Harris's nomination. I want the history books to say that Joe understood his moment in history and stepped aside voluntarily.
He didn't. Well, I'm glad that you want that.
I want that for his legacy.
Well,
I don't know. I wasn't in those rooms. But you know
what Nancy Pelosi said? We could do this the easy way.
That's what
or
I hear.
We could do it the hard way.
That's what I hear. Here's what I think. I think that we're at a moment where the cynicism that I think has you've rightly earned, and we all have, living through what we've lived through. You're not that much older. You may not. I don't even know that you are older than I am.
I definitely know than you are.
But, you know, we have reason to be cynical, but I really think that that is to our own detriment. We are at a crossroads in this country of whether we continue with democracy or just go full-fledged into authoritarianism. That's the option that we have. And democracy, here's the issue. I don't know your nickname for Obama, but I was actually a Clinton guy.
The bungler?
Even in 2008. And so that probably even makes me even worse. But, you know, I believe that
you're
in
from Arkansas, though.
There
so
we go.
We're going to give you a pass.
I get a pass.
You're the only person who gets a pass.
Thank you. Finally, those Arkansas roots, like, help me.
It's you couldn't
like,
help it. You couldn't
I
help
couldn't
it.
Help it. It's in the water down there. Beaver Lake has the Clinton molecules. But I...
Is it white water?
It's... Oh, yeah. Right. Sorry. Whitewater.
Sorry, buddy.
you know, you've got DuPont water, I've got white water. What can I do? So, you know, but because I thought in 2008, I thought that Hillary understood who the Republican Party was in a way that I couldn't be optimistic the way that Barack Obama called us to be in 2008. But that was only half of the call, I think. And I think that we all got excited and showed up to the rallies and yes, we can. And then we all said we did the work. We voted and we went home and we let Barack do what he did for 8 years. And then we all felt really pissed off that we didn't get what we all wanted when we elected him. That's not democracy. Democracy is hard work. We have to hold our elected officials accountable day by day. This is why you and I fight for our FOIA laws. This is why you and I fight for the right to vote. This is why we fight these petty fights with Democratic Party leaders, is because democracy is a contact sport. It is making contact with your neighbors and your friends in your school boards, in the classrooms, in the universities. We can't just say, oh, I voted in November, see you in 2, 4, 8 years. And so I know that I'm asking a lot of people who have a lot on their plates, but we have designed this system where we have an opportunity to self-govern for better or worse, and you get the government you deserve. And so I think we're at a crossroads. I think the difference between Kamala Harris and Joe Biden is that 22 years, and I think that actually does matter, because I want to believe that the buck stops there in the Oval Office. I want to believe that I can trust that my president is making the tough decisions that a president has to make and is doing it on behalf of the people whom she serves, not on behalf of herself.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll say this. On the Obama point, I was all in, you know. And I think the thing that Obama did, and it wasn't just, it's one of those things like what came first. It's like a chicken or the egg argument. Because I think you're correct in saying that, you know, the mass movement that elected Barack Obama didn't really continue to push forward. But Obama himself made sure that the mass movement that got him elected, he was sort of like the first sort of internet, we're going to get out people like on the internet and drive people like that. He made sure that that was co-opted by his own political machine. It wasn't allowed to, which again, if it was me, would I allow it to? Tell me to dictate to me what I'm doing? No, maybe not. But that's what happened. That political machine was co-opted and put into a corner and not allowed to do the thing that you're talking about, to push forward and hold people accountable and hold people to do the things that we would like them to do. And so I do not have any faith that we can do that, because I don't think that that coalition is in a position to demand anything. It's in a position to be marginalized again. And until somebody proves to me that it's not, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not getting on board with it.
I think like, I'd rather be marginalized in a marginalized Democratic Party than marginalized in a fascist regime.
Well, here's what I'll say.
And that's on one hand,
I do. I agree with that. Like, they're I'm not someone who argues like that everything's the same. I don't necessarily think that. But I also don't think that the difference is that great. You know, Trump was president for 4 years, and we're still here. You know, we didn't. It wasn't great. Bad things happened.
Oh, Rob, it's so different.
The Supreme Court is terrible.
It's so different.
But you see, I don't want to be put into a situation to be like, we have to do this, or we're all going to be sort of wrapped up in some sort of fascist, you know, movement in America, because I it's not going to happen.
Oh gosh,
I don't think so.
See, I thought you were cynical. That's the most optimistic thing I've heard.
Well, I mean,
there's nothing. All the guardrails are off. You just had a court saying that the president could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, yeah, and there's nothing we can do about it other than impeachment.
But any president can do that.
Sure.
Not just one. That's the thing. I think that's the thing. It's like,
but this president
is Palantir. Is the thing that I mentioned at the beginning. You know, is the arms to Ukraine and Israel, is the saber rattling and pretending like China's gonna go over top of us and we're not gonna be able to like have hamburgers anymore or something, like, is all of that sort of fear mongering, is all of that real? I if it is, I don't care. Like, I simply don't. I don't want to send more arms to Israel, and I don't care if China takes Taiwan.
Yeah, but you're saying that in a city that was occupied longer than any other American city by the National Guard when we had to deal with riots after the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination.
You don't think a Democratic administration would send the National Guard in here? I do. The fact of the matter is that the security state. The idea that, look, I'll put it this way. I'm not a capitalist. So it doesn't really matter, Democrat or Republican. The playing board is slanted toward people who own everything already. And it's going to continue to be that. Now, adjustments around the edges could happen.
We're talking about a Trump budget that's $5.2 trillion further into the deficit because he wants to keep the tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans.
I don't agree with that. I agree with that.
So let's talk about the values. I mean, I don't think these are marginal differences between Kamala Harris wanting child tax credits and you know, agree or disagree with the first-time homebuyer proposal. But, like, we're talking about shifting wealth from the wealthiest to the neediest is on one side of the ledger, and keeping the rich get richer, the poor get poorer on the other. I mean, I'd rather that's our direction in the road. I don't understand why it's even a debate.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't think that the difference that you're describing is real. That's true. But I'll go back to, we were talking about Obama before, and this is very similar to the arguments that people made for Obama over Romney, say, or McCain, or Bill Clinton back in the day. And Bill Clinton and Obama were disasters. I would argue that those kind of politics actually helped foment a resentment and a feeling in the country that created a situation. I'm not saying it brought on a Trumpian sort of rise, but it sort of created the conditions for that to happen, because there wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. Like you can say that there is a difference, and there is, but is it enough? Are we going to have this conversation again in 4 years? Probably. 5 to 8 years, probably. And I want more.
Yeah.
I want more. I don't think this is good enough.
I am with you. And I think that's where I have been so discouraged of late, because it has been increasingly challenging for me to identify what makes us the good guys.
So now here we go. Here it comes, everyone. Here comes the big story. So here's how I'm going to start it out. I think it was maybe 2 years ago. It might have been more. Carl would probably remember. We had a conversation in here with Jordan Pusey, our friend and comrade, about their RD, their Democratic committee, whatever. And the conversation was like, okay, well, this one family sort of like, and their friends sort of ran the RD. And, you know, they weren't very good. And it was just like a, you know, four or five people, whatever. It was like a father and a daughter and his wife and their friends or whatever. And the bylaws said that if you don't come to these meetings, you can't vote. And so people who were more sort of active, more advocacy and activist oriented were like, well, we're going to bring people and we're going to vote these people out and we're going to have our own RD. Well, then of course the old people then decide, well, we're going to hold on to our leadership positions in this RD. So we're going to have people come, and you can't vote for the leaders of the RD unless you go to two meetings. So we'll tell you to come, or we won't tell the meeting, and then people will come. And we had this whole discussion about this fucking RD in Ellesmere or whatever. And the thing that stuck with me after having that discussion is I thought, like, what the fuck is this for? Like, for what purpose?
Yeah.
Like, what's it for? So fast forward to today. The Wilmington Democratic Party is in disarray. It's in chaos right now. Cassandra Marshall, who has been the chair of the Wilmington Democratic Committee, who's been a thorn in my side, thorn in the side is probably the wrong way to put it, but I mean I think her project, such as it is perfectly described by what I said before. Like, yeah, you like the idea of being the person, but there's nothing there, whatever. And I think that people have started to say, well, we'd like to do something different. And now we're in a situation where we have total chaos. Can you explain to me what in the hell is going on in Wilmington? Is it similar to what I described in the other RD, where like people were not involved and we wanted a new set of leaders in there to do something different? And if they were going to do something different, what the hell was it? Like what sort of things can be done if it's new people? What are the old people doing? Because as far as I'm concerned, it's pointless. But I don't know. So I'm hoping that you can tell me.
Right. Well, I don't know that I have evidence of it not being pointless. But I can certainly
thank you.
Give you a front row seat to what's been going on in Wilmington. And this, you know, this really does frustrate me. I have been on the state executive committee. I'm my RD secretary. I am... you know, I've held the party ball in a lot of ways, and it has been frustrating to say the least, because I ask myself this question. I go to these meetings and I say, what's the point? What are we doing here? And there's a tension in the Democratic Party, which might shock you given the recent Delaware Democrats endorsements, between whether the party should be involved in the primaries or completely hands off in the primaries. And this election cycle, the Delaware Democratic Party decided that they were going to be hands-on and endorse folks, starting with Joe Biden. I was the only person to object to that endorsement because I had this was after the debate. I had some grave concerns about whether he would make it to the ballot in November. Turns out I had reason to be concerned.
Turns out you were correct.
Thanks. That was not a popular opinion. And what I saw was an entire room cave into groupthink, not receptive to any analysis, thought, independent thinking, criticism whatsoever. And we endorsed Joe Biden. We endorsed Lisa Blunt Rochester for Senate. Then we endorsed Sarah McBride for representative. That's when folks started speaking up saying, oh, you know, if there's a primary, I think the Democratic Party should stay out of it. Nonetheless, the motion to endorse by acclamation passed, which this is like where I start looking at the room and say, do you understand how this works? Like, if you don't think the party should endorse, then an endorsement by acclamation, you should object and say, all right, I'll abstain from that vote, but a vote should take place. That didn't happen. Go to Governor Bethany Hall Long, again, by acclamation. Kyle Evans Gay. And then we close out the meeting. Cassandra Marshall is a voting member of the State Executive Committee, but was not present at that meeting. Nor did she, and this is where Cassandra and I started to part ways. Because as a voting, I'm the Wilmington at-large member for the State Executive Committee. And part of the process for endorsements by the party is that they take recommendations from the subdivisions. So if there were a purpose of the parties, it would be to energize candidates' bases to be involved in the party so that they could get this endorsement, so they could say, I'm the future of the party, and these are our values, and this is where we're taking us forward. If there was a purpose, that's one we might select. And the primaries give us a vehicle to do that, to take these recommendations from the smallest subdivisions to the largest subdivisions, and those recommendations go up the chain to the state party. And I asked Cassandra Marshall. She canceled the city executive committee meeting that was supposed to be held before the state endorsement meeting. And I said, oh, does this mean we're not going to have a recommendation vote on these statewide endorsement decisions that you and I and Lynn Fuller, our treasurer, are supposed to take next week? And she said, well, there's not interest in doing that. And I said, well, how do you know you haven't held the recommendation meeting? You can't say there's no interest for something you've never provided as an opportunity for input.
She knows everyone's opinion.
She knows everyone's opinion, though she's asked for no one's opinion. And so that was kind of the breakdown there. I was like, okay, fine. And I just emailed everybody. I said, hey, if you have an opinion, let me know. And this tells you, like, the only people emailing back and forth on this chain that had the entire city executive committee are me and Cassandra. Nobody else is having any input to this conversation whatsoever. So the party is on life support at best. There's not a whole lot of energy in the room. Then I find out, I'm at a conference in Chicago, and I find out that Newcastle County and Wilmington hosted a joint endorsement meeting for the county-wide seats. Well, here, you read the bylaws of the Delaware Democratic Party, you read the bylaws of the city committee. We are supposed to be a party about transparency and notice and participation. They didn't invite anybody except the voting members. So nobody even knew, unless you were, you know, checking the Del Dems website, which I don't know how you spend your free time, but that's not how I spend
mine. I do not. Actually, I block myself from that.
There you go. You would not know that this meeting had occurred. We still to this day have not received the minutes of that meeting. So I have no idea who was endorsed, who was not endorsed. There's been no communication about it whatsoever. So not a properly noticed meeting, not a properly invited meeting. And I said, what's going on here? Like, there, you know, I'm the RD secretary. I didn't get to send to my members an opportunity to tell me who they want to endorse in countywide races. Y'all are supposed to consider recommendations from the subdivisions on endorsement decisions. This entire process has been cut short to be just the people who you want it to be. It's a need-to-know situation rather than an open and transparent process. And then Cassandra, and listen, I've been serving as Cassandra's parliamentarian for 4 years. You know, she's trusted my guidance all this time. And all of a sudden she decides, I don't know the rules. And she's like, get back to me when you've learned the rules. I'm like, okay, I'm pretty sure I know what rule I'm citing here. Meanwhile, Cassandra plans a get out the vote event at the convention center here in Wilmington, spends $4,700 without any authorization from the city executive committee. The event, and we just learned that this week. We just learned how much it actually costs this week. She introduces the idea in June. I'm the only person on the city executive committee to say, what are we getting out the vote for on a Saturday morning in July? There are no ballots out. We're not endorsing in primary races because Cassandra has already made it clear that she doesn't want the city to get involved transparently in that process, though she's doing plenty behind the scenes in that process. And, you know, what's the point of this? Well, get to the event and maybe 20 people show up. The candidates who show up are pissed because what a waste of your time to spend a Saturday, summer Saturday, at the convention center talking to people who are all going to vote for you anyway, and most would otherwise be volunteering on your campaign, knocking on doors, actually doing the work of getting out the vote. Totally pointless event.
Who were the candidates? These were countywide candidates?
They were really proud that I think Sarah McBride showed up.
Yeah, because she's got a real tough... She's got a real tough road.
Exactly.
To get to the House.
Yeah. They had a Biden campaign official.
How is LBR gonna make it to the Senate through that through the incredible opposition of nobody?
Yeah, it's pretty frustrating. And so we spent, you know, nearly $5,000 on a pointless event, and had no conversation about it until I pushed the issue. I said, listen, if you spent more than $600, that's what our bylaws say, you have to get approval by the city executive committee. And I think that that's a good practice. If you're on a board of an organization and you're about to spend...
There should be some limit, $500,000, whatever.
Sure. And if you're going to spend more than that, then, like, let's have a conversation and be like, is that really what we want to spend our money on? No conversation. Cassandra just spends the money. And then finally, after I raise a stink and say, hey, no one authorized you to do that, This week at their city executive committee, they finally ratified the expenditure, which they can do under the rules. I was disgusted that nobody was like, you spent how much? Like, this is not a great use of our funds, but whatever. It's fine. Not disqualifying. Here's the big issue that I have been really frustrated with is that unbeknownst to I think many on the city executive committee, there has been this musical chairs routine of ward leadership serving on the city executive committee, not being duly elected by their ward. We're the Democratic Party. We should be embracing democratic processes.
So how's that work? Somebody just steps up from a ward and it's like, I'm going to do this. And they just like sort of add them to the mix. How does that work?
Kind of, sort of.
Cassandra, I take back everything I said. I want to be a ward. I support everything you're saying.
There you go. Yeah.
That's very strange. But again, it goes to my point before, like, what is it really for? It's just for you to feel like you're doing a thing, you know?
Right. No, exactly. I do not know what they're doing. They opened this week's meeting talking about all the busy work they have to do for the primaries. I'm like, what is the party doing for the primary? You've not endorsed on the city candidate races. You're taking a sideline. Half of the people who are members of the city executive committee have their own campaigns that they're running. James Dalk was on the city executive committee. He's running for city council. Kobe Owens was on the city executive committee. He's running for city council. Thea Lopez running for city council. You know, so it's all the same people in the same room patting themselves on the back that they're involved in the Democratic Party without involving Democrats. And I think that that is suffocating our membership and participation. So you have a fifth ward who reached out to us in June and said, hey, listen, we don't have a chair of our ward. Well, that's the first I had heard of it, because Christine had been serving as ward chair in the fifth ward. And I forwarded it to Cassandra, and I was like, if this is true that they haven't had an organization meeting, then it's been more than 60 days, because that was supposed to happen 2 years ago. So there would be an appointment. The city executive committee would appoint. But I have no record that they've never organized in the first place. So fast forward to the next city exec meeting, and Carrie Christine, out of the blue, announces, I've moved out of the ward, which according to our bylaws makes her instantaneously no longer the chair of the ward, which creates a vacancy. And as soon as a vacancy is created, members of the ward at their next meeting elect a new ward chair. The members of the fifth ward were like, listen, it is July 29th. We are ready to go. Let's call a meeting and elect a ward chair. They email everybody that they have on their roster. They host a meeting. And their vice chair, Jerry, is very upset about why it's rushed. Well, the bylaws say you only have 60 days to fill it, or it gets appointed by the city executive committee. Plus, there's a primary that people want to be involved with and hold candidate forums for. So there's good reason if the party's going to do something.
It's an election year. Let's chop chop.
There you go. Exactly. And you have these members who are enthusiastic. So like you, I am now cynical and think that there's no point in doing any of this shit. But you have these people who are taking this optimism and saying, let's get together. Let's host a candidate forum. Let's be Democrats and be involved. If I were Cassandra Marshall, I would have welcomed them with open arms. Finally, some new blood. Nope. She didn't know these people, or she didn't like these people, and decided, no, I'm going to appoint my own person. And this is offensive and disrespectful to Carrie Christine, who's already selected her successor, which is not what the rules say at all. Carrie, at the last meeting this week, was all offended, butt sore, that I did all this work, dedicated all this time, which no one ever questioned. It's just like, read the rules. Cassandra then tried to do it in my ward. My ward chair stepped down. Cassandra decided that Chuck Fleming, who I don't even think is a member of any of our EDs, but has been our ward chair in the past, years ago, is going to be the new ward chair. I said, Cassandra, butt out of this. This is for the ward to elect their new ward chair, not for you to appoint someone who's going to kiss your ass. So what we have is a city executive committee that will not stand up to Cassandra Marshall. I have no idea why. I don't know what they're afraid of, because I don't know what difference it makes.
Yeah, I think what your explanation there just reinforces my idea that I don't know what difference it makes. It was funny. I was telling you before we started, I was talking to Kobe last week. And I sort of mentioned this, and he was like, hey, you want to step up? And I was like, no, absolutely not. I won't do any of this, because it doesn't do anything. Whether somebody picks their successor or the ward votes on them, obviously following the rules and being more democratic is the right thing to do. But ultimately, in the end, what does it do? Like, What do those wards and what does the Wilmington Democratic Committee do? And when you're like, well, they endorse Sarah McBride, and and Lisa Mert Rochester, like, who gives a shit? Like, who cares? Like,
yeah.
This is going back to the thing about the Democrat. Like, there's so much more that we could do if we just ignore that. Because it's not like Sarah McBride and Lisa and all that. That all takes care of itself. That's already established bullshit. Like, if we want new blood and we want new people and we want new ideas, we should do a new thing. That's what I think.
Right. Well,
you know what
this,
I mean?
So here's where I think split ways a little bit, is that I think that the Democratic Party could serve as that vehicle to what I was talking about earlier, about democracy is an action verb. It's a contact sport. And I think the party, if we followed our rules and engaged our neighbors and said, let's meet and figure out what our ward cares about as Democrats who share these values, and had the deep grassroots involvement and cared about listening to what people are facing, cared about their water bills, cared about their parking tickets, cared about the development that's going down without any set asides for people based on their income, cared about the unhoused who are in our community, who care about whether the riverfront is stifling free speech, who care about any of the number of issues in our city that has plenty of issues for us to care about that impact people's day-to-day lives. I think that people get frustrated because they don't know the vehicle to express those interests, and people don't have a lot of time. And so it's like, who's going to go to the city council meeting? Who has the time to go to the city council meeting? Wouldn't it be really great if we knew that we had a party that could hold our Democratic elected leaders accountable? If we had a party chair that said, I have the weight of the city Democrats behind me, and if I tell them I'm kicking all your asses out because you're not doing what our voters want, and they step up and listen, I don't know. That's a mechanism to do that little d democracy work. And I think that the party has a mechanism to do that, but not if we're going to strangle it out from the top the way Cassandra Marshall has.
Yeah, and I think about stuff, James Dalkic, yeah. So I had never heard, I went to Cheyenne and Miriam ran a candidate forum for like at large in a few different districts. I missed the first one, but I saw the second one. And I was really impressed with him because he was the only person who basically said, hey, you know, one of the big problems is the city is basically run by a sort of moneyed interest through the mayor. You know, Przycki and BPG and real estate sort of interests. You know, they're going to build a whole new riverfront east, you know, in a floodplain down there in the South Bridge. And no one can really stop them, you know. No one has the power or the guts or whatever to fucking stop them. And if Carney's elected, God forbid, no one's going to stop him either. And so, the idea that you're just sort of like protecting your own fiefdom while you let, you know, moneyed interests like Przycki, Carney, etc., run the city, it's fucking pointless. And yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if we want a robust sort of argument about whether or not we should do this, and people sort of getting involved through the party, it can't run this way. But again, I think it's very telling that it does run this way, because the people who have been sort of drawn into the set system that their name's on the top of a list of an org chart, and they can call a meeting and they can tell you you're not the parliamentarian or whatever. Like, that's not who, nobody cares about that.
Right.
And so, you know, I understand trying to sort of wrestle that mechanism away from people who are fucking useless. I mean, let's be honest. Cassandra Marshall's fucking useless. But trying to wrestle this mechanism away from people who are useless to people who actually want to come together to decide what to do would be meaningful. But you could bring all those people together and do something else. You know, you don't have to let them die on the fucking vine. You know, they've never done anything for me or you or anybody else. They controlled a minor mechanism that was in place that could be used, as you suggest. It could be used to support candidates who have different ideas. It could be used to get people all together in a ward and find you know, new people who want to do something new. It could be. I think you're exactly right. But it's not going to be. So fuck it. Let her jump into the fucking river. Let's start something else, you know?
Yeah.
Let's start something else. Because, yeah, I mean, it's not, it's pointless. It's an exercise in futility. It's just like we're jerking each other off.
Yeah.
And it's not getting anywhere. But I mean, but what you said is correct. There is a mechanism there, and there's an apparatus there, and an infrastructure there that could be leveraged to do the things you're saying.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, and this is exactly why we've got to win more Working Families Party seats in city council. This is exactly why we've got to win. We've got to take it away from the Democratic Party infrastructure, because I think you're right. We could let it die on the vine, but I'm also a realist in that many of the council members identify as, you know, as Democrats. And so who they answer to are going to be registered Democrats. And, you know, I shared with you, I've been a Democrat since the second grade, you know, watching my governor, Bill Clinton, at the DNC and then inauguration in my second grade classroom. You know, it's in my DNA to identify that way. I don't give monthly to the Democratic Party. I do give monthly to the Working Families Party. So, you know, I think that I don't necessarily disagree. I don't know that this party will die on the vine. And I'm also not sure I'm willing to take the risk, because at the same time, I don't, even locally, if that's true, that Cassandra Marshall does not matter. And I don't even know that Jamie Harrison at the top really matters. But what does matter is Democratic turnout by black and brown voters, men in our urban centers, to make sure that we don't have a fascist president coming up. And I, you know, and we're going to have to mobilize that base of voters and mobilize them by sharing what our values are. And we can't do that if the people that the Democrats are electing as their local leaders don't share the values of transparency and participation and inclusion. So we are really screwing ourselves over. And I think not just for the city of Wilmington, but potentially for our country and our future.
Well, thank you for coming in here and talking to me.
Thanks,
I appreciate it. So here's what we got coming up, folks. Next week, we're going to have a little pre-primary, like pre-game talk. As people know, I don't care. I want to have people in here to tell me why I should care. I will tell people who I'm going to vote for, but it's important to mention that that's not it's not an endorsement. I'm not telling people who to vote for. I don't care who you vote for. As a matter of fact, I think, my personal opinion is, if I was going to tell you what to do, I'd tell you not to vote. But.
Vote. But, today's election day. Vote.
Oh, God damn it.
Tomorrow's the election day. Vote.
I should have never invited you in here. No, I'm going to tell people who I'm going to vote for so we can have a nice discussion about what you should do or what you can do. I think the coolest part of the discussion is going to be if I were in other districts. Because the problem is I don't have a lot of choices where I'm at. But there are other people who I think are in places where they can make a big difference. And I think we're going to talk about that for sure. I think Carl might have some feedback on that as well. But in any case, we'll do that. And then we're going to talk about, 2 weeks after that, we're going to talk about another big issue down there, Christina School Board. We're going to talk about setting up shell LLCs and then moving to Karachi and being like, hey, school district paid me. I'm living in Karachi. Fire the superintendent. Don't tell anybody why. So Doug Manley is going to come in and give us some information on that as well. So there's going to be tons of stuff happening here at the podcast. So, you know, you could help us out. You could help us. You can go to patreon.com/thehighlandsbunker. You could throw us $5 a month. That'd be super. You could think about maybe coming out to the Delaware Call Fall Classic baseball, because next week after Labor Day, we're going to be doing a big promotions push about coming out. York Lynn, help the call out a little bit. But there's a lot of ways you can help. And we'll keep having these arguments. We actually believe in the small D Democratic argument here. That's right. Dwayne, thanks again, man.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Left is best.